Erasing the Stigma, Conversations about Mental Health in the Legal Community. Welcome to Erasing the Stigma, Conversations about Mental Health and Wellness in the Legal Community. I'm your host, Mark Iacono, Untethered. On this podcast, we shed light on the mental health, substance abuse, and wellness issues that challenge the vitality of the legal industry. We aspire to raise your level of awareness of how law departments, law firms, and individuals can make progress in addressing those issues to make a positive impact. We will keep bringing you episodes every month for as long as these issues continue to have command and control over the well-being of the people in our industry. Today, I am privileged to have two phenomenal guests, and I'd like to say they're both repeat guests. Patrick Krill is an internationally renowned attorney, author, licensed addiction counselor. He is the principal and founder of Krill Strategies, and he works with legal organizations across the globe for the development of robust wellness programs. Patrick was the driving force behind the groundbreaking ABA Hazleton study on substance abuse and mental health issues in the legal profession. He was also a driving force behind the creation of the ABA Wellness Pledge, which many firms have subscribed to in an attempt to commit to creating healthier work environments. Paula Davis is the founder of the Stress and Resilience Institute. She's author of Beating Burnout at Work, Why Teams Hold the Secret to Being in Resilience. She's a graduate of the prestigious Applied Positive Psychology program at the University of Pennsylvania and has worked with many luminaries in the field of positive psychology. She has taught courses on resilience to the United States Army, law firms, and major corporations, and she works with clients across the country to develop more reliant, more capable employees and organizations. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. It's wonderful to be with you.
We're excited.
It's fabulous to have you back. For the audience's benefit, this is our third attempt. The first recording session was postponed because Patrick was on his sick bed. The second session was postponed because I got COVID round three. So on Monday, I did a wellness check and I got an all systems go from Patrick and Paula. And so here we are. But in the interim, from the time we were first going to record and from the date of recording this episode, we had a tragic event with the death of Vanessa Ford from Pinsett Mason. She was a prominent partner who had worked on a significant transaction over a period of several months, working 18 to 20 hours a day. She was also a wife, a mom, and a friend with a community outside of work to support and to be supported by. When that transaction closed, she, along with her colleagues, had a celebratory dinner. And the next morning, tragically fell onto a railway line in East London and died. The coroner's conclusion was she suffered an acute mental health crisis and consumed a considerable amount of alcohol, but did not rule it a suicide. In the aftermath of her death, it spurred a lot of discussion about the needs for law firms to do more to protect the mental health of their employees. Whether or not it'll spur change, I think time will see. I'd like to get the two of you to reflect on that and tie it to your thoughts on the state of our profession, because it was a jolting event, although it wasn't the first time and it won't be the last time.
It's funny, you were just recounting the story again, and I have tears in my eyes. It really, really hit me hard. There's a lot of emotions that come up for me with this story. I think first and foremost in my role of mom, and I think about her and her kids, and it makes me really upset and it makes me sad. It also makes me angry because I want there to be more done and to do more in the legal profession. And I know we're making strides and we're making our baby steps and all of that. But I feel like a lot of the underlying issues that come from this story and certainly other stories are things that we can certainly address that I think we need to be talking about more deeply and more earnestly. And so I try to also have some hope coming out of some of this, that this will continue to galvanize efforts and work. But for me, it's certainly a big swirl of emotions.
Patrick.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And Mark, you noted how much that story, that tragic story, has resonated with people and how much attention it has received. And when you were describing her, you mentioned she was a lawyer, but then also a mother, a wife, a daughter, a friend. And it's really those things, as Paula was suggesting, that I think hit people the hardest. And that's something that I think law firms and all of us in the profession need to reflect on. It's not just that a lawyer lost their life. A human being did. And we tend to think of ourselves first and foremost through our professional role. Lawyers, in many ways, over-identify with being a lawyer. And being a lawyer isn't necessarily the most sympathetic, it's not necessarily the most sympathetic role to a lot of people, but we're human beings. And we need to surface that primarily and really reflect on that and understand how our work environments are taking a very significant toll on humans and those who love them. The final point that I would add simply is that I do think this is another inflection point. There have been other inflection points. And my hope is that now in 2024, given the predicate for this conversation that has already been established over the last several years, this one might be different and that we might redouble our efforts with a level of staying power that so far has been lacking.
I really hope so. Vanessa Ford, the lawyer, didn't die. Vanessa Ford, the mother, the friend, the participant in her community, died. And a few weeks back, I had Andy Hilger, who was the former president of Allegis Group, a $12 billion human capital company, on to talk about servant leadership and stewardship and quiet leadership in a time of turmoil. And when I asked him to tell his story, he said, let me talk about the unwork first, because that's the most important. And he told me about his family and his background outside of the fact that he once ran a $12 billion company. And I think that when you look at the legal profession, we forget that the unwork is actually the most important thing.
The unwork is the most important thing. And I think that's something that people began to reflect on during the pandemic. But an additional point there, when we over-identify or have too much invested or bound up in our professional identity as a lawyer, what we also see is that inhibits our ability or willingness to seek help. For many people, because they feel like that label or that persona of lawyer comes with certain expectations that they're very reluctant to not meet. And so when we do focus more on the unwork, as it were, but also the fact that we are human beings, first and foremost, my hope is that would augment some people's comfort reaching out for help.
One of the things that came up was that Pinsett Mason had like a mental health hotline and had some programs in place. But a couple of things also came out. No one really noticed that she was in distress. So there was someone leading a major transaction of people with her 18 hours a day, and no one saw the distress. And two, there was apparently the firm programs weren't invoked. And so it ties in with the discussion today. Based on where you've seen this retrospectively, and for the audience, Patrick and Paula wrote an article in 2019 about how a law firm should consider building a wellness program. What have you observed with respect to the efficacy of the programs that firms have attempted to put in place to date?
So I can certainly say from my side of the equation, I think the vast majority of the programs that I see tend to be one-off, somewhat reactionary, somewhat one-size-fits-all. We can check the box now and say, like, we accomplished a something, perhaps, and we're good. And I want to caveat that, though, by saying across industry, that tends to be the approach with well-being and mental health topics, at least as I see them and as I view them. And so part of what I try to take on in my work is to help those who are hiring me and bringing me in start to, if nothing else, think about what are the long-term goals that you might have, not necessarily with the specific reason you're bringing me in, but with this content? What does this look like for all of you in 6 months, in 12 months? What can we do in addition to one program to keep the learning going? There's different ways and different pieces of the puzzle. We can talk about adding one-on-one coaching. We can talk about adding on-demand content. There are other ways and other lots of different types or styles of ways to communicate the learning. I'm not 100% sure we're there yet in terms of intuitively thinking about that, but we have to start thinking about and moving beyond just these kind of one step, first step, check the box kind of entry points into this conversation. And I think we're really ready now. We're what, 6-7 years into this conversation for that next step to be taken.
Patrick, our good friend, Dr. Larry Richard, talks about upstream and downstream problems. And I got it backwards when I interviewed him. I was thinking of upstream being people at the bottom percolating up. And he and I got to a better understanding. Downstream is, here's what's happening. Upstream is, why is it happening? And so as you've done work with firms across the globe, what has been the emphasis, or what's your perception of the emphasis on the upstream causes? Because a lot of the interventions and programs have been designed downstream to help individuals at different states. But what's been your view of the upstream approach to the solutions?
It's been wanting, it's been lacking, it's been insufficient. But before I elaborate on that point, I do want to just say a word about the downstream approaches. You could also frame it as being proactive and reactive, right? So what is a firm doing upstream that is proactive to mitigate inbound stress or to help mitigate some of the problems that people are likely to encounter? But then that downstream or reactive, that's resource provision, right? Providing resources that people can typically voluntarily avail themselves of when they need them. Firms have done an okay job there, and in some cases, a very good job, depending on the organization, providing enhanced access to counseling, better benefits, other resources that people can utilize that theoretically could help them in a time of need. I do think that there's a need to recognize progress where it has occurred, and there I have seen some progress. That said, going back to the point we were making earlier, there are a lot of reasons why people in distress are reluctant to reach out, take advantage of those resources. They might not even fully understand them or know that they're there, but then there also could be a lot of stigma, fear, et cetera, associated with taking that step to help themselves. And so simply putting the resource there on a shelf that people can reach up and grab if they need it is inadequate. There needs to be a little bit more direction, and sometimes we need to be willing to be directive to push people towards those resources. But back to your question about the upstream efforts, I think that's where we need to focus our attention now and next. For a firm that hasn't done a good job yet of beefing up their downstream resources, I would say work on that. But for those who have, what are the processes? What are the protocols? What are the behavioral and cultural norms within your organization that tend to cause unnecessary stress, that tend to weigh on people and create expectations that are very difficult to fulfill? Do you have people working 18 hours a day on deals without anyone checking in, without anyone suggesting they take a break or step back? That would be a clear example of something that a firm, I think, should have a protocol and a process in place to address and prevent.
It's interesting because I look on the sidelines of a professional sports team, like an NFL game. And who do they have on the sidelines? They have trainers. They have sources of nutrition. They have doctors. They have x-ray facilities in the stadium. They have all sorts of things for the players to be able to function in that environment. Yet when a lawyer is working an 18-hour day for months, there aren't typically arrangements made to bring the family in for a dinner once or twice a week. And there aren't wellness checks to see if someone's getting out for twice a day for a 15-minute walk, or making sure that the food they're getting is proper nutrition. We don't provide the sort of support services for these competitors in a competitive environment that we do in other settings. And I think it's unfortunate because that's part of upstreaming solutions is understanding the support during the times when the profession is unavoidably stressful, because we can't eliminate stress entirely. Now, the two of you have developed a program, a learning program called the Legal Wellbeing Blueprint, which we're going to talk about. But I want to set the table a little bit about some of the current state of the profession. We know from the ALM larger mental health survey that the state of anxiety, depression, substance abuse, the needle hasn't really moved a lot in the 4 years. But ALM, with the assistance of Paula, just did another survey specifically on burnout, which has been a frequent topic of late and was a topic that came back to the really bubbling to the surface in the context of the Vanessa Ford discussion. And Paula, I'd like you to take us through that survey to level set why the program you've developed is so important, because there are some pretty compelling statistics in there.
Yes. And one of the things that I really wanted to jump into with doing this survey was much less about looking into rates of burnout, because we know that those are probably elevated. What I wanted to do was I wanted to look at the different dimensions of burnout, our notions of feeling exhausted chronically, cynical chronically, and then what the research calls a sense of inefficacy. So I'm just not feeling very connected to or tied to or engaged with my work. Those are the three dimensions of burnout. And I crafted some questions around each of those dimensions because I wanted to see how are those playing out in terms of frequency with the lawyers and legal professionals who responded. And I think what we found has just certainly maps onto a lot of the conversations we're definitely having now and very recently. I'll talk to you about a few pieces that jumped out at me specifically. And they were around, I wanted to know how much interaction lawyers were having with friends and family. I wanted to know if they felt like connected to hobbies and things of that nature, and if they were really feeling a sense of being able to disconnect and recover from their work. And the statement, "I have so much work to do, it takes away from family and friends," was one of the statements. And 63.3% of the respondents said a few times a week or more. So that's a group of people who are saying a few times a week or more, I don't feel like I have the capacity to interact with friends and family. Like, my work is so much and so consuming that it's pulling me away from that. When it comes to hobbies and personal interests, the percentage jumped to almost 70%. So 69.5% said, again, a few times a week or more. If we're talking about once a month, a couple of times a year, this is happening, then you can start to say, okay, maybe we're talking about certain cycles that are happening in a person's work or what have you. But when you're saying it with that frequency, like, most of the time, I can't pursue hobbies or other interests. And we know from newer research that one of the things that really can help on the individual side from preventing burnout is having what's called an opposite world. So I have an opposite world that I can go to. And again, to what we were talking about earlier, where lawyers especially tend to over-identify with being a lawyer, having an opposite world is this other place that you can go in terms of being able to disconnect from work. And I can, maybe I'm my daughter's soccer coach, or maybe I'm a master gardener, or maybe I'm taking salsa lessons with my significant other or something like that. But we're not able to do that. And then in terms of one of the statements about, am I able to leave my work behind at the end of the day, essentially, I don't think about my work much at the end of the day, was the way that the statement was written. Now we flip it. So we still see a high percentage. We see about 61% saying never, or a few times a year or less. So it's just so infrequent that we can really either mentally detach from our work or feel like we can physically detach from our work and go off and do other things that are restorative. And this is really, I think, the entry point for thinking about unmanageable workload being one of the systemic big drivers of chronic stress and burnout and disengagement. We have to start having, and this is back to that upstream question, we have to start having those types of conversations, because we're engineering a profession where people can't even do basic stuff like see their family or hang out with their family in a meaningful way, or at least to the level that they want to do it or pursue outside interests. So that was the first starting point there.
That is really great insight. And I think you wrote something it may have even been recently, about one of the preventions or barriers against burnout is making people feel like they matter.
Yes.
And if you have unmanageable workloads and your team of legal professionals, and I don't just limit it to lawyers, legal professionals can't have that holistic sense of personhood, in my view, then the message is that you really don't matter except as a production unit.
And that was one of the statements that I actually asked specifically was, do you feel like a cog in the wheel? And again, we're seeing rates, and I don't have the exact statistic in front of me, but it was higher than 55% of the respondents, again, saying with that level of frequency, I essentially just feel like a cog in the wheel. It was better at the equity partner level, of course, because now you're in the driver's seat and you've got a big seat at the table. And so we saw some relief at that point. But certainly with the non-equity partner level and at the associate level, those rates were still really high. And to your point about mattering, one of the things that we asked as well is, do you feel recognized by your colleagues? We asked about colleagues and clients, but do you feel recognized by your colleagues for your work contributions? And 44.1% of the respondents said once a month, less than a few times a year, or never. So we have this massive infrequency, even amongst ourselves, of recognizing achievement, of saying not just a thank you, but what I call a thank you plus, right? Adding a little bit extra onto the thank you to specify the behavior or strength that you saw. And it's one of the big components of mattering is I know I'm achieving or accomplishing something, but it's also the other piece is that I feel recognized. Like you're noticing me, you're thinking my work is important and you're saying something about it. So I feel a sense of significance. And so I think that's another upstream conversation that we need to start having is, and it's so simple when you dig into the research about what actually illuminates or activates recognition and appreciation and mattering. It's so basic. It can be as simple as saying good morning to somebody. It can be remembering somebody's name. It can be telling people explicitly how you rely on them and what did they do to help you, you know, or the team get to this really good outcome. And because we have such a crushing amount of work, oftentimes that workload piece in particular, we don't even think about it. We're not even thinking about like these basic, very like low hanging engagement fruit type things that we could be doing because our minds are just elsewhere and focused on so many different things.
Patrick, it's interesting because at the beginning of the podcast, you talked about the dangers of over-identification and how it can skew the way people show up and take care of themselves and their amenability to help. But what is your take in the context of they don't get a sense that they matter?
That would leave someone, I would say, in a bad place, right? It would be, I think, emotionally disappointing. I think it would be frustrating and possibly a bit hollowing out. Because if that is what you are spending all of your time doing, and it ultimately doesn't feel appreciated or doesn't feel meaningful, then that's creating that hole. And it's a hole that people might be seeking to fill, incidentally, in other ways that are maladaptive in nature, right? So we know in the world of addiction, often people fall into maladaptive substance use, problematic substance use, because they're trying to quiet something within themselves or fill some void that has otherwise materialized within them. And so I think it's potentially really harmful if people spend all of their time working at something that they don't get the recognition or feel valued for. And I'll just mention quickly, Mark, you probably saw this study that we published in 2022. It was titled People, Professionals, and Profit Centers, the Relationship Between Employer Values and Lawyer Well-Being. And what that demonstrated was very similar to what Paul is describing, where we asked lawyers in California and DC, what does your employer make you feel most valued for? And if a lawyer felt valued for their skill, their worth as a human being, their talent, their competence, they had the best mental health, physical health, and lowest risk of attrition, lowest risk of problem drinking. When they felt most valued for their billables, productivity, or responsiveness, they were in a distant second place. And if they didn't feel valued for anything, they had the worst mental health, worst physical health, highest risk of attrition, and greatest likelihood of problem drinking. And so it revealed a very clear health hierarchy that was directly associated with what people felt valued for in their workplace. And so I think, to echo what Paula said, really being intentional about this and being intentional about understanding it at the organizational and managerial level is so important. Your people are giving you a lot of themselves. They're giving you more of themselves than they're giving anyone else, and oftentimes their family. And if what they're getting in return is a lack of appreciation or a sense of fungibility, that is not going to translate into the type of health outcomes any of us want.
And we also talk about, too, a lot of the conversation is about being engaged and how can we like get people to be more engaged, or however it's phrased. And it's like, when you paint that picture, why would I be engaged, or how could I be engaged in my work, when so much about having a sense of vitality and feeling really connected to my work stems from a lot of these human factors that we're talking about that just aren't present or aren't being prioritized enough in the profession.
So it's interesting, because I've come to look at the way cultures function and their impact, not only on productivity and wellness, but on capacity to do optimum work, that by not being attuned to very common social mores of best ways that you interact with people, we are disenfranchising them, which leads them to maladaptive behaviors as well as the emotional health issues.
I'm so glad to hear you say that it's a cultural, because it's also outside of the profession, right? There are societal influences. Think of the rise of ghosting. We all know that's a huge problem. People are getting ghosted constantly, which is sending this message that you don't really matter enough for me to take 15 seconds to get back to you, even if it's turning you down for something, even if it's saying, I can't meet you for that, or whatever it is. We've become habituated, really, to this level of disregard for other people, for their sense of whether they matter and whether they're worth your time. And that is not exclusive to the legal profession. But if there are things that we can be doing within the profession to counteract those tendencies and maybe cultivate some norms that are not consistent with that, I think that would really go a long way, because we all know that feels terrible and we all know it's getting worse.
Yeah. And it's interesting, because the Surgeon General has come out with the statement that we have a loneliness epidemic in this country. We also have research that says that men in particular often can't name one close friend that they can have a deeply connective conversation with. And we know from research done, Gabriella Rosen-Kellerman and Marty Seligman and some others, that lawyers are among the loneliest professions. So the epidemic has hit the legal profession on steroids. And that makes the need to prioritize mattering as a core principle, even more important, because we're a lonely society. And Patrick, as you've noted, with ghosting and other forms of behavior on social media, we're also sometimes an increasingly more dismissive and diminutive society in how we interact with people. It amplifies the need for our profession structurally to make mattering a core value.
Exactly. I think that's precisely true and said. And we also, the final thing I'll say on the loneliness piece, Mark, I'm glad that you mentioned that. Our research from last year in 2023 on predictors of suicidal ideation among lawyers who are regularly experiencing feelings of loneliness are 2.5 times more likely to have suicidal thoughts. So it's a meaningful risk factor in that regard as well.
It is. And the stigma around reaching out for help and showing vulnerability among a population that's an outlier with respect to the ability to show vulnerability only compounds the loneliness issue.
And I think it also, I've been doing more work with partners in particular, and I've had some interesting conversations with them. And what I hear is more anecdotal, but I'm trying to tease apart how to help lawyers more and things of that nature. One of the things that I usually will recommend or say to them or in the context of our conversation is there somebody within your practice group or is there somebody who you've just gotten to know over the years or what have you that you can just sit down and have a cup of coffee with and just explain a little bit about here's what's going on. And the hesitation that I am universally met with in that regard and that sense of this is still a really hyper-competitive environment. Even though we've ascended to the level of partner ranks, we're still being, you know, looked at. We're being constantly watched in terms of production of business development efforts and how much bill, how much client work and book of business and all of that is coming in. There's just such a profound hesitation to even see each other as people that we could reach out to if we're struggling or having a hard time. It's just, it's a really tough aspect of this issue.
It is. And the way our minds work is interesting because I wasn't diagnosed with bipolar disease until I was 42. I knew something was wrong. I knew that the hypomanic episodes, I didn't have a label for them. And the periods where I would go to work, but behind my eyes would be a river of what I call black tears, wasn't right. But as a litigator, I kept thinking, if I go to a therapist and they take notes, if God forbid, for some reason, I'm involved in a lawsuit, my history and whatever I tell that therapist is going to be discoverable. That inhibitor about disclosure prevented me personally for a long time from getting the help I need.
But I think you're also touching on something that's really key and something that on the rare instances I've had a chance to see it, it's just been one of the more powerful things I've ever experienced. And that's the power of story. When you have someone, particularly in a leadership position, who stands up and says, this is, I've struggled with X, Y, and Z. And it doesn't even necessarily need to be a mental health issue. It could be the last deal that I worked on. We had all sorts of challenges. I wasn't sleeping well. And this is how we worked through it. Just recently, I was at a program where the practice group chair for a practice group stood up and talked about his experience with burning out and how he overcame that and what he has to do today very consciously to make sure he doesn't go back to that place, but how he, you know, was able to, you know, continue on with a successful career and be a practice group chair. And just the overwhelming response to his remarks, like wild applause. And he and I have been staying in touch and just he's been telling me about different conversations that he's had now with people in his group that he doesn't think would have come about but for that. And it feels like weakness in the moment, but it really looks like strength to a lot of other people. And that's the mindset that we need to think about. But I think stories are one of the most powerful ways to level the playing field and make people think, oh, okay, I don't have to just keep walking around holding it all in. My practice group leader struggled with this and overcame it. And here I'm learning some lessons from this person. I can maybe say something too, or at least I know if I get to that point, I have an outlet potentially to have a conversation with somebody who might be able to help me.
Absolutely. Now I want to get to your latest venture, which is called the Legal Wellbeing Blueprint. I stated at the beginning of the podcast, you wrote an article about how firms might think about creating wellness programs in 2019. And just this year, I think you debuted the Legal Wellbeing Blueprint, which is a mixture of virtual and distance learning. And I'd like you to talk about what the impetus was for that, and then we'll get into what it entailed.
Sure. Thanks. I guess I'd just say at the outset, Paula and I have known each other and worked together in various contexts for 7 or 8 years now. And so to the impetus for this course, we were chatting, having a periodic kind of check-in last year about things that we were seeing in our respective work and the trends that were emerging and the needs that we were both observing. And it turned out we were both observing a very similar phenomenon, which is that those in law firms or legal departments who were tasked with, interested in, or otherwise responsible for leading the firm's well-being or wellness efforts didn't have much, if any, support at their disposal. They didn't have any training available to them. They were coming at the work from wildly different perspectives and experiences. There was no coherent, cohesive baseline level of information that was available to these people to help them develop anything resembling a best practice. And that is going to be essential as we seek to make improvement around these issues, developing some best practices, establishing some norms, and creating some uniformity in what is an effective approach. What are the ingredients that you need to have? And as Paul and I were discussing that, we realized that we should probably put together a course that could help people in those roles to share our experiences, our perspectives, research, and help create that dialogue and foster that type of baseline knowledge that our hope is going to be really helpful so that these people will be able to go back to their firms, back to their legal departments, use all that knowledge to help the organization.
Yeah. And I think to our point earlier, I think we're both, Patrick and I are both really keen on thinking about what are some of those deeper root cause-y issues that we can start to tackle and address from our areas of expertise that can help others. I think about it back with my military examples. How can we put more boots on the ground? How can we have more people who have this level of knowledge who can now go back and serve their law firms and corporate legal departments in a very different way so that they can start to advance this conversation from within and feel confident that they're able to. One of the big modules that we talk about is the business case, that they feel comfortable and competent talking about different ways to approach. If we have leaders who aren't yet bought in, or we've got people who are thinking about this, but they're not sure, that there are different sort of perspectives or pathways that they can take to help create the buy-in. And then that business case becomes a really important pathway for a lot of people to have some foundational knowledge in. And so I think that's one of the unique aspects of our course for sure. But I think, Patrick, you can certainly chime in, but one of my big aha moments, and part of the reason why I love leading these types of courses, is that I learn from them as well. And I think we also realized, or maybe I certainly realized, that there's a lot of siloing going on in this area of firms as well. And so a lot of wellness and being professionals are oftentimes part of the HR function on some level, but they're not talking to the learning and development folks. They're not talking to the professional development folks. They're not talking to the DE&I folks. They're not talking to the other people where a lot of this work just overlaps. And if we could understand what are each of these lanes doing? How can we cross collaborate? How can we share budgets? How can we put on programs where it's marketed across these different lanes to elevate really how we're talking about some of these topics and maybe putting a different spin on it so it seems fresh for folks, I think was one of the big outcomes and takeaways certainly that I had.
I think that's really important because one of the things that's been lacking, I think, in firm and legal department mental health initiatives is that it's not been thought of as an enterprise approach.
Yeah.
And Paula, you hit on something really important, is that there are different groups and constituencies within a firm, learning and development, talent acquisition, DE&I, and there's a through line to wellness. And so there should be an ecosystem and interdependencies. And I think that you're right. The siloing has been one inhibitor to success. The other thing that we talked about in our preparation was the need, and Patrick alluded to this in his introduction of the impetus for the program, is the need for like common nomenclature, terms of art, basically standardized meanings. And I want you to talk about that a little bit, because there's been fragmentation and how you've tried to design unfragmentation. I don't even know if that's a word, but to defragment.
to defrag these efforts within the law firm world. I think it really goes back, from my perspective, I think it goes to the idea of needing to have some baseline competence around these issues. Many of the people that are involved with, now some firms, to be clear, do have, for example, a director of well-being or a director of wellness, but many of the people that are involved with this work are coming at it because they've either been asked to do it or they've raised their hand and said, I'm interested in this. This is something I want to support, but they don't necessarily have any prior education, experience, or background in the subject matter to help them really develop a program that is going to be efficacious and that is going to have some impact and some staying power within the organization. And so being able to give them some skills, some baseline competence that can give them the tools and also the confidence to go back to their firm and implement their efforts more effectively, I think is the goal. One thing that I want to make sure doesn't get lost in the conversation, and this circles back to obviously the tragic experience the tragedy we were discussing earlier, where people said they didn't see warning signs. You hear that with tragedies that happen all the time. And sometimes it's not necessarily a tragedy, it's a problem, right? It's in the context of figuring out how malpractice occurred or something, how a significant mistake occurred. And people say, I didn't see any signs of distress or I didn't notice anything. But then the follow-up question really needs to be, and it's never asked, did you know what you were looking for? Would you or the right people within your team or the organization have felt comfortable saying, I know what to look for and I didn't see anything? And that's an example of that baseline level of competence that I think we really need to be imparting. Because otherwise, if you simply say, I didn't know what to look for, it doesn't mean anything if you didn't have that level of training and knowledge, or if enough people within the organization didn't have that level of training and knowledge. And I think that's a norm that we need to expect. And I think we need to expect firms to start living up to that level of awareness.
I think that's an incredibly impactful point, which is, if you didn't see it, then the question is why? And then the next question is, how do I see it in the future? And those following two questions after that declarative statement that I didn't see it don't get asked often, if at all. So I'd like you to take us through the components of the course, because there's substantive modules and then there's a hybrid virtual component. And if you could take us through what participants could expect and what the end product of certification is, I think it'd be really useful, especially as we try to grow the competency in this field. One thing I've noticed with apartments is there's no trade association for law firm wellness professionals. And so this program fills a tremendous void.
Sure. And one of the things I'll say before we get into the actual flow of the course is that we really encourage not just folks with well-being or wellness titles, but we really are looking for folks across all of those different lanes and pathways, because I think that's one of the biggest benefits that can come from what we're talking about is, how do we start to have those cross conversations? And so I think that's an important point. But we kick off the course really talking about just really, how did we get here? What is an overview? Like, where did we come from? Where are we going? And spend some time talking about that in the first module. And then really spend most of that second module talking about the business case. Patrick and I are really aligned in thinking that it is such an important piece of this conversation that there has to be some sort of fluency and just, again, baseline competency around how you make or pitch some of these arguments and what the connection is. And luckily, the science is advancing so that we're able to make now some pretty robust connections and arguments between being better well-being and good, you know, financial outcomes and things that firms are really paying attention to. So that's that. And then, Patrick, I'll let you talk about your segments.
Sure. As Paula notes, the introduction and the business case modules really are essential. They're foundational to everything that follows. And I would also echo that business case piece is really important. And I would say everyone in the class was very focused on that so that they would have better arguments, better rationale, and a clearer understanding of the mechanics of how well-being or focus on mental health can help the firm succeed so that they could carry that message back to the firm. But then the next two modules that I lead primarily are focused on mental health, substance misuse. Not only how do you recognize these problems, but how do you respond to them? Really intending to give everyone who's a participant in this course some tools and some awareness at a level that I think is sufficient, at least for purposes of this class, that they can walk back to their firm and say, I think I know now some of the things I need to be thinking about. I think I know now some of the trainings that we should probably be offering. I think I know some of the resources that are available out there within the profession that we should be contacting, developing relationships with. Their level of skill around mental health crises and substance use problems is enhanced after those two modules.
So this kind of goes back to your statement of a few minutes ago, should help people know what to ask and what to look for, and then how to respond.
And then following that, we have the first of what are two group coaching sessions. So we deliver those first four substantive modules where it's primarily Paula and I teaching the courses, obviously with people able to ask questions throughout. But then we regroup with no set agenda except to answer people's questions, to respond to their thoughts, their reactions from the first four modules, and to walk through hypotheticals and case studies. So maybe they've heard some things and they think they understand that. They think they understand that concept, but they're not sure. And the cohort, our inaugural cohort, was 20 people plus Paula and I. And it was a great number because it was a large enough group where you had a variety of perspectives, a small enough group where people didn't necessarily get lost in the conversation. And certainly everyone had the opportunity to bring their questions and to talk through their reaction to the material. And then following that group coaching session, I pass the baton to Paula and she picks up with two modules that obviously she should explain.
I get into, again, just thinking about some different entry points to help them start to think about I use an intersection approach, right? We're not just talking about any one pathway or lane, but I talk a little bit about resilience. I talk a little bit about the science of engagement. There's some positive psychology thrown in there. There's a little bit of positive organizational psychology in there as well. Probably a little bit of things that I touch on when I would do more of a traditional burnout program. But it's this combination of pieces to the puzzle that I want them to understand that there's lots of different pathways and there's lots of different entry points to program around some of these topics for them to gain their own additional interest in some of these topics. And again, to what we were talking about earlier, we're really sticklers about definitions, and we always try to start each of our segments with, okay, we're talking about resilience. What does that actually mean? Because there are a lot of misunderstandings and misperceptions about a variety of these topics, just simply because as ideas in these programs and things around well-being grow and continue, we can sometimes lose some of that definitional relevancy, which becomes really important if we're going to be talking about how to address some of these pieces. So I talk about the core six drivers of chronic stress and disengagement in the workplace because I want them to be able to start promoting that core root cause sort of conversation within their firms. And so that we're, again, trying to move out of that square one, just soul square one approach. But then I try to mix it up a little bit. I talk a little bit about, in my world, they're called icebergs, but our narratives, our core values and beliefs about the way we think the world should operate. And in our last group coaching session, that opened up a phenomenal, I talk about some mental strength skills. So we talk about how to limit catastrophizing again, so they can build up their own fluency around this and see how these concepts apply to them. But then they can also feel more comfortable having a model or a skill or a strategy or an idea that they can start using in coaching conversations, perhaps if they're working with lawyers. And then we talk a little bit about developing some relationships, some great research talking about micro stress and using relationships to help us deal with micro stress and seven big categories of relationships that we need. And then I finished talking again a lot about that sticky recognition and mattering component, because I think it's just such an important undercurrent tying together and running through so much of what we talk about. So that's split up over two modules. So three skills in each module. And then we finish with another group coaching session where, again, no agenda, and we open it up for them. And we found the discussion so interesting and robust, we actually decided to schedule an optional week 9. So our course is 8 weeks long. We schedule an optional week 9, and I think we had about half of the folks take us up on that. And we just, again, had a really enlightening, wonderful conversation. But all of our teachings, all of the modules are recorded. folks have to attend 6 out of 8 in order to earn their certificates. And we have a portal. So all of the recordings are housed there. People can access at any time for however long they need to. We have a very robust library of different types of formal research studies to articles that we've written, other articles we just think are interesting that we've populated the portal with. And so that they have this ongoing resource to keep coming back to going forward.
The one thing just to add quickly, Mark, is that Paula and I were talking about what we were teaching, right? The content that we were covering, the skills that we were helping people develop, they also learned from each other. And I think that was part of the magic of the course as well. It's obviously we're the instructors, but we had a great cohort and we had people who were willing to share their experience or share their frustrations or ask questions or offer solutions to their colleagues. And so that really did add a lot of value to the overall experience, was what our students brought to the table.
And I was going to ask for each of you, what are a couple of things that you learned from teaching from your cohort?
Go ahead.
Please go ahead.
I was just going to say, for me, one of the big things was one thing that I mentioned already was I did not have the perception or understanding of really how siloed people were and feeling like, I don't know who to talk to. I don't know what other people in my own firm are talking about within this context. I'm not even sure who I could go to. Like, how do I get these conversations started? Like, really, I think that was probably my biggest aha moment, was realizing that sense of, wow, we're really not strategizing or talking or having any level of figuring out how we can all talk about this topic in a cohesive way.
Yeah, I was struck by, and I knew this right from my work, but seeing it together in a class like this, in that type of container, I was struck by how wildly different firms are, how wildly different their approaches and their progress levels. They're really all over the place in terms of what they're doing, what they're thinking about, the progress they're making, the progress they're not making. And if you think about it in terms of visualizing like a scatter plot or something, really, law firms are all over the place. There isn't this core area or a lot of common ground yet in terms of the approaches that they're taking or the experiences that they're having or the level of support that they have from their leadership. You have some firms where that support is very clear, it's very real, it's backed up, it's tangible. And you have other firms where it's really not there yet at all. And I think for me going forward, trying to think about how we can get this group and get all of these stakeholders more closely aligned around some core best practices and hopefully some norms around organizational buy-in is going to be really important.
And I think this is honestly, I think this is one of the things that we intentionally wanted from the course as well, is to make sure that they now know that they have each other to rely on. And as we continue to offer additional cohorts and build the courses out and things of that nature, building that ever expanding pool of folks who now know that they can pick up the phone or they can send an email to a colleague and follow up with something or say, hey, we tried this and we're not sure about it. Did your firms try this too? I think is a big piece of what we wanted to come from this as well.
The two of you are doing fabulous work. And I think that as you touch lives and as you train people, you're going to see the importance of this program and the competencies begin to cascade throughout those in the legal profession, both specifically wellness professionals in the profession, but generally the level of awareness from other participants in the profession. And I personally thank you for the work you've done, because it is truly important and vital, and it fills a huge void. Before we leave, can you each tell our listeners how to get a hold of you and how to learn more about the Legal Wellbeing Blueprint?
Yes. So one of the things we wanted to make sure to mention is that we're going to kick off our second cohort on April 26th. So our next iteration of this course is going to start on April 26th so that we hope folks are keen to attend or, again, continue to develop their skills. Folks can reach out to me directly. I'm Paula at stressandresilience.com. My website is stressandresilience.com. LinkedIn at Paula Davis.
Patrick. And my email is prkrill.com. Krill Strategies is my company. My email is patrick@prkrill.com. And there's a landing page for the course. It's wellbeingforlaw.com. So all one word, wellbeingforlaw.com. People can read about the course. They can register directly on the site. And they can, I think, probably later this week, read some of the really great testimonials that we got, which, going back to that point about mattering, Paula and I were really gratified by what some of the people in the class had to share with us following the conclusion of that first cohort. It helped them, and they appreciated that, and they appreciated the people who took the class with them, and that was really heartening for both of us.
That is really terrific to hear, and I know that for the two of you who have committed so much of your life and your work to increasing the well-being of our profession, then getting that feedback, it just fuels your already formidable amount of inspiration. I want to thank the two of you for being on the show and for taking the time to prep with me and for the work you do, because it's truly important. And I think that there's going to be amazing benefits from what you're doing. So thank you for coming back on the show.
Thanks so much, Mark. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
It really is. Yeah, I enjoyed this quite a bit. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And this has been the latest episode of Erasing the Stigma, Conversations about Mental Health and Wellness in the Legal Community. I'm Mark Iacono, your host, and I'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to Erasing the Stigma, Conversations about Mental Health in the Legal Community. This podcast has been brought to you by Mark Iacono Untethered. You can reach me at miacono25@gmail.com. You can also reach me on Instagram at miacono25. And I hope you enjoyed this podcast and the stories we have to tell and share, both now and in the coming months.